welcome to Wanda Stix, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. This
Hello.
We're listening to The Sea, and that is a song by Gina Breedlove. And we are joined in the studio by Marie Laura. How do you pronounce your last name, Marie?
Marie-Laure Vercombe.
Vercombe, yeah. And Marie is going to be talking to us about the Green Cross International Water for Life and Peace Program, which she has been director of since 2010. And some different activities have been going on there that I'm sure you would be really interested in, particularly the Aqua for Life International program that's providing safe drinking water in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, specifically some new countries. And so really happy to have you join us, Marie. What time is it there?
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. What time is it where you're calling us from?
It is 4 in the afternoon. I'm calling you from Paris. So it's a little later in the day, but it's fine. It works out. Well, thank you again. Thank you again so much for your interest. Green Cross, just to give you a little background information, Green Cross was founded by President Gorbachev in 93. So we just celebrated our 20th birthday last year. And we are a green NGO working on development issues, and yes, water and access to water and the sharing of this precious resource is a key issue in the world. Access to safe drinking water is unfortunately one of the biggest development challenges in many regions, and actually even in our developed countries, in Europe, in Japan, and in the U.S., there are pockets of populations who struggle to pay for their water and who cannot actually afford, who sometimes have to choose between electricity and water. And so we at Green Cross work on the human right to safe drinking water and sanitation. In our countries, we are fortunate to have safe water when you have water. But in many countries of the world, especially developing countries, people do not have any safe water available to drink. So they drink water that makes them sick, and that is actually the second cause of infant mortality in the world. And that is true in many countries in Africa, in South America, in Asia, and it's a very important issue, and that's why Green Cross has been working on this since its creation, to have this right recognized, and it has been recognized at the UN 4 years ago now. And now we work with countries to have this right implemented and become a reality. So that leads me to the Water for Life and Peace program that you were talking about. We work on three main issues. One, this human right, for it to be recognized and become a reality. Second, on what we call transboundary waters, and that is water courses and groundwater that is shared between several countries. That is a big, big issue of cooperation and of, you know, people talk more and more about water wars, and it's an issue we have to watch. There is too few agreements in the world, and between countries, and it's a very unstable, destabilizing issue, and a key development issue, of course. And then the third one that you've heard about, the third main activity, is to actually, you know, develop project, on the ground project for communities who do not have access to fresh drinking and to safe drinking water and sanitation. And yes, one of our key partner is Giorgio Armani, his group. You know, they feel they have a connection with the topic of water, and they are working with UNICEF and with Green Cross in the world to provide access to water to, you know, underserved communities. And so you've heard about our announcement of the renewal of this partnership. And this year we're going to work in 6 countries, so it's very exciting in terms of, you know, outreach. We're very, very grateful to be able to basically build water supply systems. That's what we're doing. We're working from scratch in communities that have, we're not even going to talk about, you know, water grids or supply networks or, no, we're talking about rural communities where people are relying on springs and infected water. So we're going to build water supply system and really change the lives of these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the Green Cross announcement that I read last week, it was right. I think it was on Earth Day. I believe that this announcement I might have actually gotten this announcement.
Yes,
and,
that's true.
Yeah. And in it you mentioned in Abidjan, the Green Cross congratulates Ivory Coast for taking a key step to become the 32nd country to ratify the United Nations Water Courses Convention. And you mentioned that three more nations need to follow suit for a treaty to enter into force, in turn ushering in the first global framework to share the world's cross-border water courses and connected underground reservoirs. And then mm-hmm. you quote Cote d'Ivoire's parliament adopting on the 19th of November last year a law allowing the West African country to ratify the treaty officially known as Convention on the Law of the Non-Navigational Uses of International Water Courses. And
mm-hmm.
what that means. And Cote d'Ivoire's accession follows those of ECOWAS member states, Guinea-Bissau, Nigeria, Niger, Burkina Faso, Benin, and confirms mm-hmm. West Africa's leadership in realizing this ambitious legal framework on the use, management, and protection of international water courses. And you quote the Cote d'Ivoire's president, Kofi
Mahika.
And he says, ratification and implementation of the UN Water Courses Convention will enable West African countries like Cote d'Ivoire to better share, manage, and protect their transboundary basins like the Volta mm-hmm. River. And then you continue in the press release. Almost two-thirds of all fresh water is generated by the world's 276 international water courses, just 40% of which are served by a cooperative agreement between states. And it has to do with wildlife, of course. But I was thinking about the international dumping, and the United States in particular dumps toxic waste, technical toxic waste like computers and radios and those kinds of things in West Africa, specifically Nigeria, and it creates in other countries in Africa, and it creates a real toxic space that's, you know, once we dump it as a nation, cleanup is almost impossible. Whereas mm-hmm. There are ways to recycle, you know, the different parts of a computer so that they are not toxic. And I was wondering sort of where that dumping plays a role in these agreements that, you know, Green Cross is involved in.
Yes, well, we have, and that's not the water program directly, but my colleagues have been working on the most polluted cases in the world with the Blacksmith Institute, which is, you know, very well renowned institute working on toxic pollutions like that. And for sure, I don't know about the specific case you're referring to, but I know that for Europe, and it's unfortunately probably true for American companies working, you know, in other countries, we tend to do what's illegal in our countries elsewhere in the world, and that's very, very sad. How does this play in the context of what you were referring to, the UN Water Courses Convention? The UN Water Courses Convention is what we call a framework convention. So it's really the highest level of legal governance, and it's really about how two or more countries, when there are more, are going to cooperate to jointly manage and protect and develop, because it's also about economic and agricultural development, for instance, their shared water course. And a lot of countries, there's a lot of, you know, asymmetry of power on these issues. Usually the upstream country, the one that is at the source, has a lot of power, of course. And in many regions of the world, it's a big source of tension, of inequality and of, you know, unsustainable practices with, as you say, it could be some pollution. It could be whether, you know, the country could extract, take too much water from the water course, leaving too little water for the downstream countries, which is very unfair. But it could be also about polluting it. And this water course convention provides a framework that says to all of the, what we call them, riparian states, to all of their obligations towards the others, and that is to prevent significant harm, for instance. So a country and its, you know, it could be industrial stakeholders, you know, are required legally to take the necessary measures to prevent this. Now, it's with your neighboring countries. It's not, for instance, it would not apply directly to the U.S., to U.S. deeds in Africa, because it's not neighboring countries, not about a shared water course. But you have other treaties, you know, about that. You know, you have other kinds of obligations, whether it is, you know, about your obligations in preserving a healthy environment and, you know, not harming the populations. There are other kinds of obligations that can be human rights obligations, and that can be specific treaty obligations. Usually when something happens in a territory, it is the responsibility of the country, but then the country has usually contract and agreements with, you know, if it's an American company, for instance, working in Africa, well, you know, they're not supposed to be just there randomly dumping their waste. You know, there has to be some agreement and regulation preventing this. So there is usually a way for citizens and for countries and communities to denounce those deeds and those facts and to go to court about this. Unfortunately, it's easy for a lot of the, you know, multinational groups to just go, you know, and do what they want in those countries, and that's very unfortunate. That's kind of my answer. You know, it's different. We're talking about different international treaties, but in the end, the more you provide, you know, some legal governance that is binding, the more you secure, and you secure the environment, and that's what Green Cross wants to see happen. It's, we're promoting what's called environmental security. We have to, you know, sustainably use our natural resources, because we need to preserve the environment. We rely on the environment, and ultimately, of course, it has a big impact on, you know, how sustainably we're going to develop economically, and how, you know, people's health is going to be preserved as well.
Yeah, because I was just thinking, with regards to you know, the fresh water, that if there's pollution and the groundwater is contaminated, then there goes, you know, a water source. And with, you know, global warming, a lot of land is becoming you know, there are more deserts, you know, becoming you know, developing where there once were, you know, arable land. So those spaces are shrinking, and mm-hmm. with the mining, and, you know, mining takes a lot of water, and oil consumption that takes a lot of water. You know, these spaces are shrinking.
Yes.
And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. They are. Yes, and that's a big issue also of, as you say, urban land is a huge issue. We pollute land, we pollute fresh water, we overuse it. It's all putting a lot of pressure on our ecosystems and on their ability to renew themselves and to sustain the services, including agriculture, you know, that we rely on. And agriculture, to give you an example, is, well, quote-unquote responsible for 70% of the water used in the world, of the water we're using in the world. So there's a lot of progress that can be made on how much water we use for agriculture on one side. That's a really key issue. We have to promote sustainable ways of growing our food. And as consumers, we have to be careful about how the food we eat is produced, and water used for agriculture is really, really a very, very important thing to watch. Then you have 22% for the industry, and that's a world average. I mean, in countries that produce a lot of food, like the U.S., and also have a big industry, you know, the percentage might be a little different. But that's, so 70% for agriculture, 22% for the industry, and 8% for domestic use. That's how much water we use, you know, to water our, you know, grass and to clean and to cook and to drink and to shower. That's 8% on average in the world. So, you know, it's important to have these figures in mind to encourage, you know, to buy responsibly goods, if we can, that are sustainably produced. And so there is the water that is used for to produce our food or the goods that we buy every day. There's also, as you said, the question of arable land and the fact that, you know, more and more countries actually buy land in other countries. And I would name, you know, the most obvious, the two most famous are China and Saudi Arabia. China, because of the size of their population, they just need more land to grow more food to secure their food security. And also, well, the Saudis, you know, it's an arid area, so they have to use, they actually buy land and grow their food elsewhere too. That's another responsibility. It's putting developing countries in a position where they're not necessarily choosing what's being done on their land, but they have to, because they just need to develop and, you know, generate revenues to develop their own countries too. And in this context, you know, too much water is often used too, way too much water. And it's not water for the people who live there. Actually, the people who live there usually lack water because all their water is used to grow food for people elsewhere. But that's also something that really needs to be better regulated, and you were really right to bring that up.
Yeah, and mentioning, wow, I didn't know that China and Saudi Arabia were, you know, had such have such great populations that they don't have enough space within their countries to grow their own food, so then they grow their food elsewhere. Where do they grow their food elsewhere? Like what countries does China grow its food in Saudi Arabia?
It's mostly in Africa. In Africa.
What countries?
Yeah.
Well,
it's Eastern Africa is in most famous, very famous cases. You know, you can think of Kenya, Tanzania, a lot of Eastern Africa countries, because they're closer from them, and because, you know, they have the vast regions that are not really very developed and that are basically being sold out to be used for foreign uses. And that's there's a big governance gap in what's being done. Some people call it land grabbing. That's really a terminology that you'll see more and more in the media, land grabbing. And really what's being done in these countries is not always sustainable and fair for the communities. And it's, Saudi Arabia does not have such a big population, but they have a big problem in – how they can grow food. China, of course, it's mostly a population size, and also it has to do with the cost of growing food too. So basically you do it elsewhere because it's less expensive than you're in your own country. Or you do it elsewhere too, like in China, because you've polluted your land so much that it's not really producing as much as you wish it were. So you just go elsewhere and you grow food elsewhere and keep doing the same but in other regions of the world. So it's a big environmental, a big sustainability issue for a lot of people.
Wow, that's really something. You know, when they talk about land grabbing, what a euphemism. when the land is being grabbed to grow food for another nation, while there might be food deserts right in the country that is the land is being used to grow food that's being exported. Interesting. I was also thinking, yep, as you spoke about GMOs and how that, I'm thinking of India specifically, but other countries where there are no more, the original seeds are disappearing and all that are left are these genetically modified seeds which within themselves produce these crops that need more water than the native seeds. So then that creates a shortage of water as well as, you know,
yeah,
water and hunger,
mm-hmm,
and they all sort of like follow one another.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking to, you know, someone who works for a green NGO, so don't expect us to applaud this. Now a lot of GMOs are also, designed to use less water. That's clearly an issue that they've been trying to address. Actually, you'll see in their communication that they say that they're going to help the world feed itself and save the water crisis. Because all the water problems that we're facing, they're growing, are basically falling under what we call the global water crisis. Now, as you said, there's a seed issue, there's a biodiversity issue. There are many, many issues falling under the GMOs one, and we are not very much in favor of them. And that's, and a lot of mistakes have been done in the past years, and we promote what's called agroecology, which is something very different.
What's that, agroecology?
Agroecology, well, it's agriculture that is in touch with its impact on the environment, of, you know, promoting what we called local consumption of agricultural goods, you know, and basically limiting as much as possible the impact on the sustainability of the land we're using to grow food. And so you have to respect a diversity of the crops. You have to definitely, use as much as possible the local food that has been historically produced. I mean, you know, when you import, when you start to grow GMOs or you start to develop intensive agriculture, you really disrupt the environment. It's inevitable. So ultimately, as you said, there's a huge problem of arable land. Arable land in the world is shrinking. It's shrinking because we exhaust the soil, and it took, you know, thousands of years for the soil to become this, you know, to become rich and to be able to feed and to grow food. Once you exhaust it, and we've done that in many regions in just a few decades, it takes just as much time to get a soil healthy again. So with, you know, pesticides and, the shrinking of arable land and the decline of biodiversity, and by having monoculture, by growing monoculture that is, like, say, you know, wheat for, I don't know, huge surfaces, you have a huge impact. And it's very short-term policies that have been developing this, and we're now trying to address the consequences of this. And in many cases, unfortunately, we're just headlong rush, you know, just not doing the right thing, just trying to find short-term answers again. And so as far as we're concerned, you know, we really want to encourage sustainable practices and sustainable, you know, agriculture practices.
Right.
And I think a lot of people are becoming more and more aware of this. It's just really important. Awareness is key. Awareness is key, and you're not going to find as much information as you want, you know, on products, and not there isn't enough accountability. But I think in the U.S. particularly, there's a lot of awareness. People are more and more aware of what they eat, and when they can afford, they try to do something about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to let our audience know a little bit about you. I didn't read your bio yet. I want to let our audience know that I already mentioned that you've been director of Green Cross's International Water for Life and Peace Program since 2010. You're a French national, and you graduated with a Bachelor's of Arts in Political Science at New York University and a Master's Dual Degree from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and the Institute d'Etudes Politiques.
Etudes Politiques, which means political studies.
Okay, in Paris, okay.
Yes.
And before starting with Green Cross International, you worked with the organization in France as Director of Communications and Advocacy. You started your professional life in New York City working communications before joining the French mission to the UN, where you spent a year assisting its human rights experts in New York and Geneva. And you also worked as a consultant between 2008 and 2010. You're fluent in multiple languages, including French and Spanish, obviously English, because you're speaking English to us. And you're immensely satisfied to coordinate the Green Cross International Water for Life and Peace Program, which comprises advocacy and concrete on-the-ground projects. So have you visited these various nations where you know, there's serious water scarcity?
Yes, I've been several times to West Africa. I've been to Ghana, Burkina Faso, and Ivory Coast. And so, again, it's not always water scarcity in terms of an availability of water. For instance, if you go to Ghana and Ivory Coast, most of the countries are very green. They are, you know, there's a lot of water. It's more what we call economic scarcity, meaning that there's just the country is not developed enough to provide water networks and all sorts of infrastructure for its people. So you have, there's water everywhere, you have trees and springs and rivers, but people actually do drink very bad water. So bad not because there is industrial waste necessarily, but because it's contaminated with all sorts of parasites. And, you know, imagine drinking from a spring or, you know, any river that looks brown. A lot of people are not, also not always aware of what's harming them. They're not aware that it is, you know, what's in the water that's making them sick. And that's also because of, you know, lack of education and of awareness. And that's also a huge development issue. So sometimes water is, water scarcity is physical, meaning like in Burkina Faso, which is a Sahelian country, sometimes it's, we talk about economic scarcity. That's for, so I've been traveling in Africa quite a lot, also in southern parts, southern countries, and I've been to Bolivia and Argentina, and, well, to many of the countries that we've been to. We've developed a project in China, in Yunnan, which is in the Mekong Basin, and there, you know, they're also suffering from, you know, a physical and economic scarcity, actually, and they're, you know, so they're poor communities, just to say it simply, and we've built water systems to secure the supply of the people. And I haven't been there yet, but I'm going to go soon to see how it's been done. And this year, since thanks to Giorgio Armani support, we're going to start working in Sri Lanka, which is an island country near India. And there again, you know, it's you know, most countries, every country suffers from climate change now, which means that, you know, the rainfall patterns are much more unpredictable, and predictability is very important for, you know, to grow food, to grow agriculture. So the poorest people who actually produce our food are the ones who are suffering the most in terms of revenue and of production. And so in China, it's the same. You know, they've suffered the biggest drought in the century, in over a century. And you have more, it's more and more chronic. You have more and more drought and floods in other regions. And that's really how you see climate change, you know, impacting countries, because climate change you can tell by climate change through the water cycle. So it's usually, there's always a climate change component in what we're doing over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have a few more minutes?
I do.
Okay, great. Yeah, because I was just reading, you know, from the report that just talking about sort of the different dimensions of the water crisis. You've already touched on it, demographic growth and economic development, putting unprecedented pressure on renewable but finite water sources, resources, and fragile ecosystems, especially in arid regions. And the report mentions by 2025, 1,800 million people are expected to live in countries or regions with absolute water scarcity, decreasing water resources, increased population, climate change, urbanization, and growing demand are other hallmarks of the water crisis. And I'm in California, and you probably know of the mountaintop removal is really bad for the environment. And in California, we have a water scarcity issue. We haven't had, you know, sort of the right levels of rainfall in many years, and we are seeing that in sort of scarcity of certain foods, that and also looking at how the seasons are really shifting, not just in California but throughout the country. You know, really, really hot in some regions and really, really cold in others, and having, you know, hurricanes in places where they haven't had any in a long time. And then we're looking at fracking here in California and other places in the country, but here, and what that does to the environment. So, yeah, it's not just, quote, third world countries with regards to the water scarcity. And then you mentioned how many children are dying each year from the consequence of unsafe drinking water. One of your GCI chief operating officer, Adam, how do you pronounce Adam's last name?
Kuniszewski, it's a Polish name.
Yeah. He mentions that about 3,000 children die each year. And this is
not each year, not each day.
No, each day. Each day.
It's, yeah, that's why we're seeing. Yeah, and he mentions, I don't know if you have this reference, but you have the UN that said, basically, imagine having five Boeing 747 crashing every day with full of children. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, it's horrible to think of it. And these are so preventable deaths, and these are children who are dying from, usually it's just diarrhea, but chronic diarrhea, because the water they drink is not safe. And it's just, you know, killing them of diarrhea. It's unacceptable, completely unacceptable. And that's, yes, that's poverty at the worst level for you, you know, because you can't even drink safe water. And you lack education, so your parents are not necessarily aware that if they boil the water, they can save, they can prevent those diseases.
Yeah.
So it's it's really, really sad. And it's one of the greatest challenge, development challenge. It's been addressed in what's called the Millennium Development Goals that were adopted at the UN in the year 2000 and that come to an end next year in 2015 and will be replaced by what's called the Sustainable Development Goals, which will incorporate more of sustainability, more of the sustainability dimensions, which is good, you know, because it's not only about funding development, it's also about how we continue to develop ourselves. And a lot of progress has been made. I mean, this figure, this horrific figure of 3,000 children dying every day of diarrhea was much bigger. It was twice as big, more or less, 15 years ago. So there's been progress that's been made, but it's, you know, it's diarrhea is killing the most vulnerable, and basically that is the children and the eldest. And that will continue until you have universal access to safe drinking water. And we're not talking about, you know, the most sophisticated and expensive bottled water, you know, and it's but a safe borehole, safe storage, because it's a lot of times, you know, people have access to safe source, but then it's the way they store water that allows contamination when they drink it. And also, of course, there is access to medication, because diarrhea is something you can cure. But when it's chronic, and that's what's happening in this country, it's chronic and it hits really bad a child, and their life is lost, which is completely tragic. So there's a lot of mobilization around this. And in the U.S., you actually also have a great advocate for this, which is Matt Damon, you know, who's been promoting an NGO called water.org. So I'm advertising a bit for a colleague in the U.S., water.org. And it's important that people become aware of this, because I think that a lot of people don't know that, especially in our countries, it's so remote from us. We a lot of people really don't know that people are dying because of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking about cholera epidemic in Haiti, and you know, that's a waterborne disease, and you know, since the earthquake, I mean, Haiti had sort of unstable water access, you know, clean drinking water before the earthquake, which was 5 years ago, and it continues. It's been exacerbated, and now the cholera epidemic, and then I was just in Zimbabwe. Like it was last year, and in Zimbabwe, in Harare, there's no drinking, there's no running water. You turn on the faucet, and there's no water comes out of it. And if you have money, you can buy water. If you don't have money, then you're kind of stuck. And I'm like, and people have these beautiful mansions, and they have no running water. So sometimes, you know, they can find a borehole, and they can get water out of that. Otherwise, they've got to go back and forth to, you know, the pumps. And depending on where you live, that could be an all-day project. And usually, you know, it's the kids and the women that do that. And you mentioned that in your report, you know, about how long it takes to get water. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, this water is not necessarily drinking water, it's water you use for washing your clothes and things like that. And one of our colleagues and good friends, Geronimo Chijaga, he dug a well in Arusha near his friends and comrades, the O'Neills, the United African Improvement Association, and just, you know, just digging that well saved the whole village. Could now just, they still to date, he dug the well like, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago. But people are able to come there, I see them, and just turn on the faucet and get their water, as opposed to having to walk who knows where with the wagons filled with the empty yellow containers, and then they fill them up, or blue containers, and then they, you know, trek back home. Or, you know, if for some people they have, you know, put the bins and the buckets and the pots on top of their heads and walk back and forth. Yeah, someone let you talk now.
Yeah, no, Zimbabwe unfortunately has had big cholera outbreaks too, and that was really very sad, very, very sad too. And you're right, Haiti has had this too. It is a killer. Fortunately, it's not in many other countries, but it's cholera is horrible. As for fetching water, I mean, again, that's a key development issue because, as you said, it's usually women and children who go, and children arrive late at school if they go, you know, and women spend their day, you know, securing food and water. I mean, it's unbelievable. And for little girls, you have also, and for women and everyone anyway, there is also the issue of sanitation, which is related because it's also the lack of sanitation that creates water pollution, especially when you have to drink from this kind of sources. It's all correlated. But then it's also a big issue for girls, for instance, who are not going to go to school because, you know, there are no toilets, there are no latrines, and they just want to expose themselves to all sorts of risks, and, you know, they don't want to go to places where there are no latrines, so they stay at home, they don't go to school, and it's a vicious cycle. And it's true for children because it's boys and girls who go get water to help their mothers, and that's, again, time that's not being done to improve your life. So it's water is really, really central in development. It's central, it's key for health, it's key for education, for development, for livelihood. It's really something that we're trying to raise awareness about. I don't know if people listening to your radio, to your blog, are interested, they can find information on our website, which is GCI, so it's Green Cross International, GCINT.org, and they want to contact us or information or other interviews or, you know, want to know how they can help in the U.S., you know, we'd be really happy to provide this information.
Oh, that's excellent. So people can actually get involved internationally in the Green Cross work?
Of course. Well, they can make a donation if they want. They can tell us, I'd like to support a project in Ivory Coast or in Kenya or, you know, in Sri Lanka or in Bolivia. We've been supported by a little, very little organization in France, a community organization. They've organized a bunch of football games, you know, selling cakes, and they've funded a borehole, which borehole is going to provide water every day for, you know, a small community anywhere in the world. So there are many things that can be done, and I think also just, you know, knowing it and talking about it, and you know, the more we're educated about the world issues, the more, you know, we make educated choices in our daily lives, and that's just really important. We're happy to engage, and they can just subscribe to your newsletter too if they want, just to have a more international overview of those issues. Follow us on social media, on Facebook. All that is accessible and simple, and we really welcome it.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, I want to mention a couple of more things again from this report and about you know, some the new initiatives and agreements. Again, you mentioned that, like most West African nations, Ivory Coast or Cote d'Ivoire depends on cross-border water courses, sharing six with its neighbors, the Volta River with Burkina Faso, Ghana, Togo, Mali, and Benin, the Calvary River with Liberia, and Guinea, the Sassandra with Guinea, the Congo with Burkina Faso, Ghana, and Mali, and the Bia and the Tano rivers with Ghana, and the Baoulé and Bago. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, that's fine. That's fine.
Fine, okay, with rivers with Mali. And that's a lot of rivers. And in all, West Africa has 28 transboundary river basins covering 71% of the region's total landmass. So these agreements are really important. And you mentioned that other African parties to the UN Water Courses Convention are Chad, Libya, Morocco, Namibia, South Africa, and Tunisia. So I see why this is such big news, because
it is big
the more
news.
Agreements
it is big,
you have,
mm-hmm.
then it's like, wow, that's really great. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're very excited about this. It's really we've worked on this a lot with a partner NGO called WWF. I'm sure you know them, the Panda, and you know, basically engaged with a lot of the national stakeholders to raise awareness about this instrument, because you know sometimes a country is going to have a basin or organization or an agreement for its major river. Named the Volta, for instance, has one, but all of the other little ones, they have nothing. And if you ratify this, if you accede to this UN Water Courses Convention, you're going to provide some legal governance to your water, you know, water resources, and that's really important. You need to protect them. You need to have some governance over them. Otherwise, you know, any upstream, downstream, or you know, can do anything, and you just have no legal protection. And you know, legal instruments provide guidance, you know, on once you've signed it, on how to manage them, on how you can be fair to your neighbors, on how you can, you know, hey, you have to remember the environment. You cannot just ruin the water ecosystem. And so that's really what's happening, and we're really happy because, as you said, 1 second. Mm-hmm. Sorry. There are about 60% of the water courses that have no agreement in the world. So the proportion is just overwhelming. And we know, as we discussed, you know, during this interview, that we're using more and more water. So we can't afford to just have no framework for their management and their protection and their development and cooperation between states, because, you know, every state is going to use more and more water. And if you have no rules, no regulation or nothing, you can be sure there's going to be more and more tensions, you know, between, you know, the water use that's being made by your neighbors. Today, you know, we're kind of in a situation where, you know, some of these water courses are not overexploited yet, are not polluted yet. But when this is going to happen, well, you can be sure that there's going to be a lot of tensions between countries and stakeholders and communities who are going to be impacted by all of this. So it's really good news. It's just the beginning. We're really happy that the convention is going to enter into force. It's really imminent. We're going to continue our work, you know, raising awareness and, you know, trying to support the decision-making processes in these countries. And hopefully this will have an impact on this very important issue.
Mm-hmm. Right. And lastly, I wanted you to mention again the campaign's fourth edition, which will support the development of water systems in new communities in Africa, specifically Ghana, Ivory Coast, or Cote d'Ivoire and Senegal, Latin America, Bolivia, and Mexico. And you have a lot of doing a lot of work in Bolivia and Mexico, and Asia, Sri Lanka, which you've mentioned. And at the Universal Exposition 2015 in Milan Expo, and the theme, which is Feeding the Planet, Energy for Life. I was wondering if you could tell us about the Milan Expo, the Universal Exposition, the 2015 Milan Expo, with this theme, and sort of the build-up towards it, and how people, besides going to the website, like what if people want to actually be on the ground and help? Is that possible?
So, you know, Milan Expo is one of those universal exhibitions, you know, that have taken place in several cities. So you've had the one in China, I think it was in Shanghai, and the next one is going to be Milan. But this time the topic is going to be really about, you know, sustainable food and energy. And so it's really great because it's going to raise awareness, and I count on them to, you know, to organize something that's going to be appealing, you know, and give perspectives and hope to all of our countries. And people, you know, people need hope, and they need to be showed the way. So I hope that this is what they'll achieve. I don't have really a lot of information about what they're going to do. There's a website for it where people can get information. It's just, you know,
okay.
I don't really know. What I can tell you is that our partner who's from Milan, Giorgio Armani, for him it will be an opportunity to show what a big name, and even if it's in the luxury industry, you know, can do to raise awareness and also to be to prove solidarity, you know, with, you know, people who actually don't even have access to fresh, to safe drinking water. So that's, I think it's really important that as customers, you know, we really reward, you know, the companies that we buy products from for doing these kind of things, because, you know, they play a big role, and it's really great when they engage on those issues. Now, again, on this project that we're going to develop, thanks to the Giorgio Armani, and it's called the Aqua for Life initiative. We're going to develop water infrastructure in these six countries, and you know, we can do more. There are many things. This can be shared on the media, and, you know, I think it's important and fair that people know that this is being done, because it's really a great initiative, and it shows, again, the kind of partnership that you can have between, you know, NGOs and communities, because it's also a partnership that links with communities, not only because they are going to benefit from it, but because they are the ones who are going to implement the projects and who are going to be in charge of maintaining them. So, you know, you have the consumer who's going to buy, let's say, Acqua di Gio fragrance from Giorgio Armani, and you have, you know, Giorgio Armani making a donation to provide water to underserved communities. And you have these communities who are going to have their lives changed because they have finally water, and who are going to be in charge of maintaining them, and who are going to have these new opportunities. So it's a chain of, you know, of partnership that is really, really interesting and giving hope. I think it's wonderful to know that, you know, what we do in our developed countries can have an impact with very far away people. So people can, again, they can convey the information, and they can contribute if they want to support a project, if they want to support a pump, you know, a water pump, or if they want to support a latrine. You know, as Matt Damon says, you know, we need to fund latrines, because you have 2.5 billion people in the world who go about their day without a latrine. I mean, just think of it a minute. It's horrible. And it just changes completely your life also. And it's very unhealthy and hygienic and all of that. So we need to fund latrines, you know. That's also very important. It's one of the biggest causes, because this is really where the water gets dirty, and this is really what's causing the death. So something also we have to address. And so people really have, you know, many opportunities to get involved in this. They can do this with Green Cross. They can do this with, you know, water.org. They can do this with UNICEF, who does a lot to improve the lives of children, of course. So, it's very small donation makes a huge difference. You know, small donation plus one small donation makes a big difference.
Right. Wow, this has been a really wonderful conversation with you, Marie-Laura, about...
Well, thank you so much, Wanda.
Yeah, about the work that, that Green Cross is doing, really, really important work And, definitely looking forward to hearing more about the work that's happening. And I'd love to talk to you once again when you've had a chance to visit some of the countries that you haven't been to before to see on the ground, you know, sort of the impact of these water systems and projects and programs on access to safe, clean water, for the communities that don't have, you know, as much access as they should have, particularly with, you know, the water being present. It's just maybe not being in the proper form to be safe, but it could be cleaned up and people can be educated, as you mentioned, and people can fund boreholes so that people don't have children and why women don't have to walk so far to get water and children go to school instead of, you know, having that kind of duty in the morning, you know, that takes all day.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your interest. I will definitely keep you posted on our next travels and perhaps also on Milan Expo if you're interested in that. This should be something definitely. And thank you very much again, and hello, everybody. have a good day in California.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're going to play this song by Fela and then get ready to talk to artists that are participating in the 25th Anniversary Shipyard Artists Spring Open Studio. So we're going to play this song, Water No Get Enemy by Fela from the musical.
So you decided to stay for the second set. 1, 2, 3, 4. In Nigeria, we have a saying, water no get enemy. Uh-huh. As a boy, it is one of those things my mother used to tell me that meant nothing and everything. So I made it into a lovely song.
That was Water, No Get Enemy by Fela Kuti, and that was from the soundtrack for the musical Fela. And we are joined in the studio, still talking about water. This time we're talking about the water in the San Francisco Bay at the Bayview Hunters Point Shipyard. And this is the 25th Anniversary Shipyard Artists Open Studios this weekend, May 3rd and May 4th. And we're joined by three of the artists. Why don't you tell us your names, and then we could talk about your work and what you, what people are going to experience when they come to your studios this weekend.
Okay. Excuse me. Good morning. My name is Naya Lark, and I'm the metalsmith artist down at the Hunters Point Shipyard.
Welcome, Ms. Lark. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And what I do basically is I do jewelry designs, and I've been down at the shipyard now for about 20 years, and I'm really excited about this particular spring open studio because, again, we are celebrating our 25th anniversary, and I have a number of collectors and new friends that come through, and I'm just really looking forward to meeting new people and showing off my work. It's also a place, too, I might add, too, that I also teach. I teach metalsmithing privately as well as through City College there. I take sterling silver sheet and wire, and I make one-of-a-kind designs. And it's an opportunity for people to come down to see my work twice a year, Spring Open Studios being one of them. Other than that, I'm available through appointments and otherwise my website. People can see my portfolio and current work and make purchases now.
Oh, great. Well, since you mentioned the website, why don't you give it to our audience?
The website is www.nayalarkjewelrydesigns.com, and my name is a little odd spelling. It is NYYALARK, jewelrydesigns.com. And I am definitely a creative individual. I did it all myself. I'm definitely into doing everything myself. That creative spirit to the fullest extent. So I'm very proud of the website, and I'd love for people to come and check it out. And there's a lot of information there, and it also mentions Spring Open Studios and being always in a creation mode, always growing.
Mm-hmm. Nice, nice. Okay, thank you so much, Ms. Lark. And other artists in the studio presently?
Hi, this is I'm Charles Tuggle. I've been down at the point for, I think, about 12 years.
Okay.
But it's kind of interesting that you play Fela because I was an art lecturer and taught art history and ran an art department in Nigeria for 4 years. And it just happened that all of that activity I'm very familiar with, because I was in Lagos and Ibadan. And the work that I'm doing currently is on Nigerian music.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so it just happened that you were playing that. I'm doing... I work in themes. I've done all kind of, I'll do shows, like 20 or 30 paintings dealing with a particular theme, Black American history, or history of blues, or the history of jazz, anything that's current interest. And last year, I did a show on Miles Davis at the Jazz Heritage. There's a Yoshi's Jazz Club here in San Francisco.
Right.
And so I was showing, I was part of an exhibition there. And so also last year, I was asked by the San Francisco African Historical Society to participate in and to do art inspired by the collection that they had on exhibit. But I was one out of the three people. I was one of the people who was who had actually lived in West Africa. So I told them that I would do something dealing with that. So I started at that point to paint and do collage based on my experiences there, as well as doing research. I was interested in the musicians that had come before, the current popular musicians, of which at that point Fela was one. So the work that I'm doing currently deals with that, as well as the political situation that was going on in transition when I was living in Nigeria. So I'm at the point, and I'm in Studio 1320, and we do have, as was mentioned by the previous artist, we do have open studio twice a year, but the rest of the time we rarely see each other at all because it's a really great place to work. it's quiet, and you see people when you want to, and it's you're surrounded by a lot of interesting people, so it's a great place.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I just found your bios. That's why I should only introduce yourself. And I'll start with you, Mr. Tuggle, that you grew up in Chicago, and when you were in high school, you always won prizes for your art.
Right.
And when you were in college, you were interested in science and studied medical technology. And
right.
Once you finished your studies in medical technology, you spent 2 years abroad studying art and translating.
Right.
And when you were in England, you studied calligraphy and studied the different characteristics of calligraphy in different languages. And
right.
You had an art studio in Hunters Point. You've had an art studio there from 1976 to 1979. And then, as you mentioned, you lived in Nigeria for several years. And then when you returned to California, you worked in radiology at a Bay Area hospital. And you
yeah,
found a way to
time.
Work part-time and then have time for your art.
Right.
Yeah, wow, you've had a really varied career, but art always called you, huh?
Yeah, well, I just, you know, I worked just enough to get benefits, and I spend, you know, just, I'm sure there's some, everybody's familiar with who does this. You work just enough to get benefits, and then you can spend the rest of the time in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty much an idea. I did that, and then I did a early retirement, so
mm-hmm.
I was able to work that out. But, yeah, I spent a lot of time,
mm-hmm.
a lot of places, so.
Yeah, very nice. Yes, we'll come back to you to talk more about sort of how, you know, various locations enter into your work. And so I believe Mr. Clarence Towers, are you the voice we haven't heard from yet?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good, I'm good, thank you. So I can read your bio since I have them now, and then you can talk, or you can talk
okay.
first and I'll read your bio. Would you like me to read your bio first?
Yes, please.
Okay, sure. Clarence Towers has been creating images with both traditional film and digital images for many years. His images are from the Northwest and Southwest United States, Europe, and Japan. He has exhibited his work in San Francisco, New York, and Chicago, as well as in Japan. His current projects include photographing cowboys, cowgirls of color, and a large format abstract landscape. And a large format abstract landscapes of the West with color transparencies, black and white film, as well as in the digital medium. That sounds really beautiful. He is the former director of the San Francisco Photography Center, considered to be the largest publicly funded photographic facility in the United States. I know that place. It is located at the Harvey Milk Center for the Arts in San Francisco. Yeah, that is a really fantastic studio. It's gorgeous because I was there when there was the Flower Children and the Black Panther Party exhibit.
Just a few months ago. Yeah.
Uh-huh,
I was there
yeah.
as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
My career started quite a few years ago, too. I worked in television with the educational station here, KQED. And I started as a photographer-filmmaker. So my background was, at the time, journalism. And since I studied English in college, there was sort of an idea to write and travel and write wonderful stories and the like. Of course, it didn't quite work out the way I had planned in that respect, but I did spend several years working as a commercial photographer. So I have pretty strong background working both in the studio and such. And that eventually, spawned an interest in doing portrait work, which is where the Cowboy Project came in. And so I've been traveling literally around the country, primarily the North and Southwest, meeting just a lot of professionals, both in the sport of rodeo as well as many people, especially in the Southwest, who are involved with Western life, and that includes, of course, ranching and rodeo and just a real interest in horses and the outdoors and the like. And so it's been a very educational experience for me to work with some of these folks, do portraits and photo documentaries of their lifestyle, because it hasn't been as well known, at least it wasn't to me when I started this project, that there were so many other people other than Europeans that were involved with Western life, though I guess that's where a lot of it began in the 1800s. So it's been a real revelation for me to meet them and just see how they live, especially around in Texas and Oklahoma and places like this. But I have spent a lot of time, as a matter of fact, I just recently got back from a road trip in the Northwest, traveling through Montana, Wyoming, Washington, and so on. And there I did both work at rodeos as well as shooting landscapes. And the landscape work has been more traditional. I shoot with large format cameras using film as well as high resolution digital cameras. And so some of the images are, excuse my saying so, pretty spectacular because of the format and quite expansive. So I've really had a lot of fun with this. And I've been showing these images at the Hunters Point shipyard for about 14 years now.
Yeah,
and so I've participated in both the spring and fall open studios, and that has been just spectacular. Even though I've done many shows around the country and in Japan, it's really nice to participate in open studios where I can show some new work, and of course it's an opportunity to not only review what I've been doing myself, but then I can share it with the public, and it's really rewarding to have people come back year after year and remember and appreciate a lot of the work you've done, and of course many purchase some of these works as well. So that's been quite exciting for me, and it sort of keeps me on pace with my interests and my progress with a lot of the work in doing the Open Studios, because then I have, each year I have something, hopefully, and usually I do, I will have something new to share with the public. And so, yeah, this has been a lot of fun for me, and I think Open Studios is just really a great opportunity also for not only the artists to meet their public and get feedback with what they do, but also just to really put your new work out there and explore possibilities. Because I get a lot of feedback, and it's good to see that so many people share a lot of these same interests that I do in my work, and so it's been great for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds, I mean, Open Studios are always really wonderful. I remember visiting Joe Sam's studio there. I don't know if he still has a studio there a while back, and my mother used to work at the Naval Shipyard, so it's always sort of like a trek through memory lane, going, you know, visiting the new studios, you know, because she did Key Punch way back when. When it was
I remember that.
Yeah, and she would give me the cards, and I would use them for flashcards and also make you know, use them as paper.
I see.
So it was nice. Yeah, it was nice you know, board, and you know, it was not as flimsy as his regular paper. So the studio is, you know, the Open Studios is really a wonderful opportunity for people to get together, as you mentioned, to check in with artists that they enjoy the work. You know, you get a chance to visit for the two Open Studios, the spring and then the later one, I believe, is in the fall. And so this is the first Open Studio of the year, isn't it? Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Right, yeah. And there's going to be the 3.9 Artist Collective, Malik Seneferu, William Rhodes, and others are going to be hosting some hands-on art activities for children and their families, so that should be really fun as well. But I believe, Mr. Tucker, you said that it's an opportunity for you all to see each other because, you know, you're in your studios and you don't get out much because you're just busy in there working.
Well, when I get back out there today, I won't have time today, but when the Open Studios actually in progress, I will definitely make a point of meeting these two people on the show.
Yeah, we should all get together.
I have no idea who they are. I mean, I know the people around me, but I just don't see people. You know, I'm there and like them, I'm sure. You know, doing the Open Studio time, and people are coming all the time, and I see friends are coming, people, and I have several people who buy my work, you know, and so I'm kind of busy, and occasionally one of my kids, they'll come down, so, and I can get around and see a few people, but usually it's people I know. But there's so much variety, and I will say that everyone I've met there, I mean, you know, they're all, so, you know, all the people I've met there, the artists, and they're all very interesting folk, and everybody definitely have very different point of view, philosophy, all of which is good. I think it enriches our general knowledge and all of that, you know. So this will be interesting. So I will see you too there at some point.
Yes, well, I look forward to that. I guess we'll all have to have a studio sitter so we can leave our spaces for a short while at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sounds so interesting, and I have an interest in both of what you two are doing. You know, I don't do jewelry myself, but I have friends that do, and then one of my cousins, T. teaches photography in Washington, so I'm interested in all that. But that sounds great.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons, in terms of my own work right now, that I was just painting for a while and doing prints. One of the reasons I've changed, I started doing a collage at this point in the last, I'd say the last 5 or 6 years, is because I've actually spent time in the Hunters Point community, and I wanted to do work which one could relate to the community, or one could relate to children, because children, the ones that I talk to or interview, or not interview as on a formal basis, they have no knowledge of, or very little knowledge of our history, music, or any of that, you know. So I wanted to start including that kind of thing in my work. So now I'm doing a lot of collage images in the work.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to come back to you, Naya Lark, about the jewelry. I was reading in your bio that nature and contrasting combination of things that feed your imagination, you write. And you know, you said that you've been metalsmithing and creating wearable art since 1983, so, you know, you have probably quite a collection. And you started while living in New York City, a city of striking contrast. Are you an East Coast native?
I most certainly am. I'm a Jersey girl. But for the most part, you know, I've always been pretty, I've never been a great lover, I think, of matching things or completely finished things. I really like the contrast of, like, diamonds and rubber together. You know, I use a lot of uncut stones as well as with finished faceted stones within my work. I think I have a pretty much underlying spiritual aspect to the work. I consider myself to be somewhat a spiritual person. And it's basically reflecting my idea of how everything is always in a process of becoming. And I think that pretty much reflects, I think, in all of our lives as individuals. And, you know, coming from, again, the East Coast Jersey and having lived in New York City, and so with a lot of diversity and a lot of art, and always being a part and being excited about being in the artist community. It's funny, I listened to, the other conversations are talking about what we did in the past, you know, our other lives and how diverse. It sounds like that we all have pretty much diverse backgrounds here. I started out in the music business while still doing jewelry, and I've worked with while I was doing jewelry to sort of de-stress at the time, but still enjoying. I was a concert sound reinforcement engineer and a recording engineer, working with Gil Scott-Heron and a lot of different artists over the years, and at the same time, I was always jewelry. That was I sort of had a dual passion. And it just, over time, it's just the focus just became more of a further exploration, I think, into the jewelry aspect. And also in my teaching, one of the things that I really emphasize in creation, I always tell people, I tell my students, it's more than just jewelry. Jewelry has a very rich cultural history. It's been used for bartering. It relates so much to the individual. So when one is actually wearing it, you're making a statement about yourself. And when I'm creating it, I'm also putting a lot of me into it. It's part of identity, which is very important to me as well. And what's really, really nice about what I get really jazzed about Open Studios is when I work, you know, normally I, you know, work in the studio alone in my own little island there. And then when Open Studios come, when, you know, people try on a piece, there's certain pieces that, oh, my gosh, I see them in a whole new light. And it's just a joy to really see people's reaction when they, you know, put on a design or a piece, which is, you know, we also say it is wearable art as well. And it's just such a joy to not only create this, but to also, you know, see the reaction from individuals, because each piece is one of a kind, and I only make one, and it's just it's a wonderful thing, wonderful exchange.
Yeah, I just wanted to say an ashe for our Igun Gil Scott Heron, and an ashe for Mary Baraka, whom I know you know because you're from New Jersey.
Yeah. Matter of fact, he was a family friend, as a matter of fact. But
okay, okay, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, but the question I wanted to ask you, and then we're going to come back to you, the other two artists, Mr. Tuggle and Mr. Towers. I wanted to ask you about sort of. I'm glad you mentioned Ifa, because I'm sort of thinking Egun, you know, all this metal stuff, right? And and I was wondering about the alchemy, you know, the magic around the metal, and sort of, you know, when you're in your workshop, you know, stirring and stirring and stirring these different elements, you know, sort of about the energy. Why don't you talk about some of the esoteric aspects of jewelry making?
Yes. You know, there is just that. I mean, there are many different forms of mediums and doing jewelry. And in terms of, there's lost wax casting, and there's fold forming. There's all these different mediums within the art form itself. But for me, I love just metal fabrication, and that means that I'm just taking just a raw sheet, just a sheet of precious metal, and I'm taking wire, and I'm just taking stones, and it's just that element of how do those pieces speak to me. You know, I could see a certain cut or a certain stone, and my approach is it's not about making it more, because nature has done such a fabulous job in and of it, you know, nature's self. I mean, there's not too much more that I can do to it other than to bring these parts together. And it's just the actual handling of the metal and the attention to detail and taking one's time and knowing when to stop, and knowing when to let the piece just go in the direction that it needs to go into. And there's such a joy. There's such a joy in the sawing and the filing and the hammering and all. And the beauty of starting out with just an idea. You know, it can, you know, it's an idea in one's mind, and then you translate it to paper and you work it out on paper, and then from paper then you pick out the, you know, materials, and you, and then from there it just, you just see it grow in form. That whole process of creation, it speaks a lot to me. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you're having like a tangible conversation with the elements, and then mm-hmm. then, you know, sort of looking at the community that develops as a result of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then people can wear this community. It's real nice.
Yes, and, you know, and in comment to what was said earlier, you know, that it is so true that there's, I love it when people come back, like through Open Studios, and they remind me of the pieces that they bought, you know, from me, and how much it still brings them joy, and how it's still attention getters for them. You know, people always like letting them know what lovely piece it is, and how it just makes them happy. And so it's you know, the whole idea, I think, of being creative and doing art and all, it's in a way I look at it in terms of, it's almost like a service back to humanity. I mean, you're giving something back. You're taking that gift of creativity and you're giving it back, you know, and that in itself is a joy as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I want to come back to Mr. Towers and Mr. Tuggle. I wanted to ask you first, Mr. Towers, you were You're born in Alameda, and now you live in San Francisco. And that should have been a really interesting type of place to grow up in. I teach at the College of Alameda. And Mary Rudge, the poet laureate for the island, she just made her ascension, just made her transition to the ancestors. Yeah, Alameda is a wonderful place. And people don't necessarily know about the black history in Alameda. I know that Jack London's the woman who took care of him and raised him, black woman, she actually lived here in Alameda, and Jack London stayed with her.
Mary Ellen Pleasant? Or, yeah.
No, okay. Mary Ellen Pleasant, San Franciscan. No, uh-huh. This sister, no, she wasn't Mary Ellen Pleasant. No, but yeah, I can't remember her name right now, but I'll look it up and I'll tell you before the show's over. But Jack London actually lived here, but there's like such a rich history here, beyond, you know, the Air Force Base, and I just wanted to know if you could talk about your work and with regards to color and composition and medium and place.
Yes, well, what I've been doing more recently, because usually when you say landscapes, you think of pretty pictures of something, one thing. And what I've been doing in the last several years is really carefully choosing the times of day that I photograph a lot of my subjects. And this is speaking, yes, more of the landscapes now. And with the advent now of digital photography, we have a lot more options in terms of, at least on the immediate side, of interpreting many of the subjects that we shoot in terms of color, shape, time of day, and it's part of it is highly technical, but pre-visualizing those options are also a real joy and a challenge to make interesting photos. I also work in black and white in traditional photography. It's with the chemicals and enlargers and so on. And on occasion, I still get back to that because that truly is the root of where photography began. And having been the director and an instructor at the Photography Center, that is pretty much what photography was, and to many people, thousands of people that have come through that place. So I still take a strong interest in that, and I've kept a lot of that equipment as well. And so the projects more recently that I've done, both with some of the landscapes as well as the cowboys, began with that black and white medium and making fine prints. Even have some things at the National Museum as a result of it. And that was, that's been a lot of fun to do that. And what I'm working with now are, in the landscape area anyway, are all color, or primarily color. And I've been using a lot of these, a lot of panoramic mediums, and it's been pretty exciting with especially the feedback I've been getting with that from a lot of the visitors at Open Studios and such. So, I'm still exploring. I'm still doing new things, and just looking forward to showing some of this work this weekend.
Yeah, what kind of cameras do you use?
Well, I use the Nikon 800E, which is a high-resolution standard format, so-called standard, I call it, because it's no longer 35 millimeter. I have Deerdorf and Cinar cameras, which are large-format cameras. They handle films from 4x5 up to 8x10. And, of course, I have a variety of lenses that goes with those. I shoot with the Hasselblad medium format camera. Mm-hmm. And I have Leicas So I have a pretty extensive arsenal of gear to work with, which is also fun because some I just choose to shoot something because of the camera itself. You know, that for example, the Leicas are a relatively small but very high quality film cameras, and if I'm shooting at some of the rodeo events, I'll have one of those as well as the digital camera to shoot portraits and, so to speak, grab shots as I see action and things happen around me. So I have a lot of fun with it. I'm, you know, kind of a photo nerd in that respect. But I do, of course, take the subjects very seriously. I've been photographing the Cowboys now for over 20 years, off and on. So it's evolving into a book project. And so I'm going through a lot of the work now, editing and embellishing some of the prints that I've done already. Mm-hmm. And there is still a continued interest. I've shown some of this work in Japan, New York, as you mentioned earlier, Chicago as well. And the interest seems to keep growing, so I'm encouraged to work still with that subject. And equipment-wise, I think I pretty much have it covered, at least so far. And that's pretty much how I work and what I work with. I do use some lighting. I've done some formal portraits of the men and women in the Western project, and that's been good, too. That's just like you would expect a fashion model to do, in the studio, and I've done a few of those as well. So I do some formal work on occasion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking, the black cowboy, African-American cowboy, and blacks in the West, African-Americans opened up a lot of these places, particularly, I usually think about in California, there are a lot of places where, people weren't able to pass, and people of African descent, were explorers, and they opened up these particular regions. Here in California, like around the Donner Pass and Squaw Valley, those particular areas. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the place where City of Oakland has a campsite. There's a museum there, and you can see exhibits of some of these African American explorers that open up some of these routes, which is really cool. With regards to your book, have you published any other books? Is this the first one for you?
No, I haven't published them myself. When I first started my career, I did a series of portraits of what was called at the time relevant lawyers, and that was one of the first book projects I did. And I provided probably 90% of the photography for that. The other work that have appeared in books have been everything from text to couple of historical books. As a matter of fact, I was just approached the other day because I did a lot of work on the Moscone Center, and it's going to be used now for a project. I will be in touch with those folks today. But the cowboy book is something that, which is how I actually started this, because back in the 70s, I didn't know that there were African-American cowboys. And that's what really spurred my interest, and I continued from there. But what I'm doing now is editing this work. I've actually shown it to a couple of publishers in New York. And at the time, I've had some interest, and, these things sometimes come in. There's sometimes a lot of interest because many urban publishers wonder where the audience is. And what I've found, actually being a photographer here in the city, is that many folks here have come from those roots, whether they're, you know, African-American or European background. And so there's, this is the old American tradition, right? Everyone loves cowboys and cowgirls, and it, or at least has had some exposure to them in their lifetime. And so this is something that's pretty basic and straightforward in a lot of ways when it comes to our culture, and our American culture anyway. And so, yes, this is hopefully people will embrace, will continue to embrace that tradition. And, yes, I'll see how it all goes. I have quite a bit of work to do on it yet, but I do have a wealth of work since I've been working on it, I guess, since mid-'80s. And so looking forward to developing it more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, the black towns, if you follow, you know, these frontiers, men and women, you know, a lot of times, you know, they were the ones that opened up territory for people of African descent. You know, we had a lot of black towns. You think about Allensworth here in, you know, sort of the southern part of California. But then there are black towns in, like, around in Contra Costa County, and you just know by the name because it's not a black town anymore. But it's like, oh, wow, this place was established by people of African descent. Like, oh, my goodness, wow, that's amazing. it's really, really quite something. And then you think about the Bill Pickett rodeo that comes through California, you know, every year, and that's real exciting as well. See black men and women on the horse, and then you have the Black Cowboys Parade in Oakland. That's a big thing, and then they go down to the Fermory Park or Little Bobby Hutton Park, and the kids and the families get a chance to touch horses and get a little ride, and if they are interested, they can actually learn about equestrian type of work and different kinds of vocations, because there are a lot of clubs in the Bay Area that young people, particularly kids in the city, can learn about, you know, horsemanship and riding horses and grooming them and all that kind of stuff, which is excellent.
Yes, exactly. You know, and I've gotten a lot of my material actually from the Bill Pickett Rodeo, both here and Los Angeles, or actually Burbank is where they go from here, and some in Colorado. And there's a couple of groups of writing groups actually that had workshops up in the Oakland Hills for some of the kids who had an interest in learning to ride, and many of them really enjoyed it, and it's a great opportunity. As a matter of fact, when I was a kid, that's where I was first exposed to horseback riding. My folks came out here from Louisiana, you know, after the war, so as many blacks did when the war was over, looking for work and a better life. And it was just totally different from what I'm told. I didn't grow up in Louisiana. I left there when I was 2 years old. But it was a totally different world for many, and, of course, a lot of those traditions were brought out here. As a matter of fact, some folks jokingly said there's probably more black people in Antioch than there is in Louisiana anymore because of those migrations. And so it's a lot of that culture, yes, has traveled. And it's, at least for me, especially in Contra Costa, such as Antioch and Pittsburgh and so on, it's been interesting to see how that that population has concentrated the way it has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My family migrated here from New Orleans in the 60s, and I grew up in San Francisco. And my younger daughter is a photographer, so that's my interest in photography.
Great, yeah.
Yeah, she went to CCAC. Mr. Tuggle, I wanted to ask you, Thanks so much for staying on a little bit longer. I didn't have another interview, so.
Oh, this is very interesting. I'm not being from this area. I'm learning a lot. I'm not from here at all. My world, like the jewelers, is another world. She's from New York. I'm from Chicago, and that's a whole different thing.
But you think about Chicago, and you think about sort of who laid the city out, right? And he also laid out Washington, D.C.
The history of Chicago, in those terms, of course, was academic history, but the real history of Chicago, where I lived, was on the Chicago South Side, and the West Side, and and the projects and all the drama that goes on. What you hear here in Oakland when I was growing up was multiplied by 10 there, and then the dream at that time was for me to move on to New York, which I did, and go to school there for a little while, and then overseas. So I was, became interested in that, and I was never, I when growing up, I was always interested in leaving Chicago and then later leaving the U.S., which has always been a dream, and following, going back to the land of the ancestors and all that. The high point for me was living in West Africa.
Yeah.
Even though I spent a lot of time in Europe, too, but Europe even whetted my appetite more for going to West Africa, because when I was living in Europe, I was meeting the Africans, and I was able to see a different side of Black history, and I was able to understand something different just from living in Europe and then coming in contact with, especially with the Africans, as opposed to the West Indians, which were another colonialized people sent to the colonies that do sugar and all the rest of it. But
So how did because Chicago, it has a rich Black history, I don't remember the name of the person who laid out the city.
But I know who you mean, the architect.
Exactly.
And they also did Central Park in New York.
Mm-hmm. Right. But, you think about, the art ensemble, and the art ensemble, they weren't just musicians. I mean, they were embodied art as a form. And they incorporated – oh, sorry, go ahead. Uh-huh.
No, I was just going to say – that's the history I'm talking about, because I went to school with the art ensemble. I know those people. Yeah, they're the people.
Oh.
I know. They're the people. Okay. We were all there in Chicago together, and we all left. All those people, they started, they performed in basements. They performed when I was at the University of Chicago. They would perform in the park there. And we all knew each other. Mm-hmm. So when they went to New York, we were all planning to go to New York. The artists, young people who were doing art and poetry and all that. Mm-hmm. And so, when they left, they went on to New York and then to Brooklyn. And then when I left, I went to Manhattan. And then I was in Manhattan for a couple of years, and then I moved overseas to England, and then from there came back to finish school and then go back to Europe. But yeah, I knew all those folks. they're all part of, they're my contemporaries. I lived down the street from Mahalia Jackson. She was a neighbor there, because the Black community there was all segregated. So we all, you know, we had role models. People saw each other. You know, it's not like now where people moved out into the suburbs and all that. You couldn't do that at that time. So all those folks that are iconic now, they weren't then. They were just neighbors, or they were people you knew, or the doctor you went to down the street, all that.
Wow. So. Yeah, the name I was thinking about is Jean-Baptiste Pointe-de-Sabo, He founded,
Yeah, he founded Chicago, and then he later came out to Washington. I think he did explorations up in Washington State and ended up, I think he died there.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned DeSable because there's a DeSable High School. And that's where I started high school, DeSable High School.
Oh, wow.
And then later I went, you know, I was just there a year. But a lot of the famous black jazz musicians, like out of the 50s, also was at DeSable High School. Gene Ammons and people like that, all was under famous band director, very strict, called Captain Diet. He was, a lot of the people went through there, or they went to Phillips High School, or both. People like Dinah Washington, you know, all these people, they all was there or in Detroit, you know, and so they were all, you know, people who, when we would go out to clubs as teenagers, or we'd have fake IDs, we'd go and listen to people like, you know, Ahmad Jamal or something, you know, who played at the Persian, all these places that are, like I said, you read about now, but at that time there were clubs and, you know, that was part of the life. Chicago nightlife.
So Pershing's is in Chicago? I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. Because Ahmed Jamal, he has a recording live at
the Persian Lounge. I was there.
Yeah.
I was right there when that happened. But, I was a teenager, you know.
Yeah.
It was a big place, yeah.
Oh,
but, I mean,
so
at the
awesome.
Time, you know, it later became, an important record, but at the time, you know, it was just another recording that was popular in the black community, but didn't get much further than that at that time.
Right.
And then
yeah.
Coltrane came through, and like I said, another friend, my wife, she was at Roosevelt University. We became friends with Anthony Braxton, who at that time was shelving books at the library, you know. and since that time, you know, he's developed, you know, into this, you know, all these people, you know. All came out of Chicago and on to New York.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I wonder if, I know Chicagoans probably know that the city was founded by a black man. I was just wondering if folks here in the United States of America know that, you know, this major metropolitan destination was founded by a black man.
I doubt it. I think so much has happened in Chicago, the Chicago politics. The history of Chicago is just, you know, it's just so colorful. So much has happened there that it's overshadowed the origins, I think, you know. And the most recent thing being that the president, you know, that's where his home is, you know.
Yeah, First Lady, born and raised,
Right, and she, where she, the neighborhood she lived in on the south side there is not far from where I lived, you know. And we all, black folks, just lived in these little row houses, and they tried to keep them up. And the parents sent their kids, you know, they worked you know, her story is sort of the story of a lot of black folk in Chicago. You know, their parents worked in these steel mills, and, you know, and they were up early in the morning, and the kids got a chance to go to college or something, you know. So.
Yeah. You think about, you know, the Nation of Islam headquarters were in Chicago. And
that, was, that wasn't far. Right.
Oh, uh-huh.
That was all near where we lived.
Mm-hmm.
So that
yeah,
was all part of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you know Idris Akamor, you know, founder of Culture Odyssey? They just had the 35th anniversary celebration in San Francisco, but the Pyramids group that he was a part of, they were they came from Chicago.
I know him.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I know all that history.
Okay, yeah. All right.
That's what I'm saying, all these people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I think his center should be more publicized. I was part of several shows there, you know. And that's also the place where the Black African, the Historical Society that I was telling you about that asked me to do this African thing. They're located in that center. They're on the second floor. And then the wife, she does a lot of interesting dance. Anyway, the partner. his partner, Rodessa Jones. She works with a lot of women in prison and all that. So... Hello?
I met her.
Hmm?
I said I had actually met her. Some years ago. I live in an artist colony here in the city.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She,
no,
she's
very dynamic.
She's
pretty dynamic. Yeah, Chicago's a good place to be from.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Yeah.
I it's been several years ago, I had a show out on the Navy Pier, and I took this, I had a couple of days to do a little tourism, and I took this architectural river tour, and that's
mm-hmm.
where I found out about the, that the city was actually designed by an African American.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just kind of stunned, you know, when you think of a city as dynamic as Chicago, right?
Well, yeah, the origins, you know, like I said, because of the, you know, highly segregated, you know, especially growing up there at that time. And so
yeah.
You didn't study those things, like in school, but they had a lot of black history people who informally taught black history. So, you know, they had black history clubs. They had Du Bois stuff. A lot of political stuff going on. You know, they had a black CP party, black communist. You know, they had all these things. And all these people, they all was about teaching history and, you know, letting you know who you were and what have you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, you know, that's real important because it was just so different on the West Coast, at least where I grew up.
Yeah.
You know, most folks were kind of in denial
right.
who they were. So it took a while, you know, to do that full circle.
Yeah.
That happened pretty much in the 60s and 70s, you know, where people became
right.
more aware.
Yeah. Well, I know, you know, it was I found it quite different coming here, you know, from the East, from the Midwest, you know.
Sure. You know, I'm very curious. Are we still on the air?
Yeah, we are, actually.
We are.
Yeah, we're going a little bit into overtime.
I wasn't sure, guys.
Yeah, I didn't know.
I
was interested in what the jeweler said about the transformative nature of her work. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that. I like that. I like what you said about that. Jewelry does have that ability, and also when you were talking about that, it made me think of all of the like fairy tales and spiritual things where a priestess would be wearing something or would put something somewhere and it would transform the person or the site or whatever it was, you know.
Oh, no, most definitely. Definitely more than an item of adornment.
Right.
You know, I recently belonged to the Metal Arts Guild, and we had we have a little different events that we attend, you know, and primarily educational. And I actually really felt so privileged to actually see the work of a jeweler, if one could say that, but I should say more of an artisan from Africa, and
mm-hmm.
it was a member of, you know, the Tuareg jewelry
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
tribe, and to actually see him actually working, you know, using, you know, the skin, you know, making the little bellows, you know, from actual previous the skin of an animal, and taking screwdrivers and sharpening them into chisels. So I'm out buying this stuff from retailers, you know, my tools, but to actually see the handwork and it goes into the jewelry and one of the crosses, I did buy one of the crosses from
mm-hmm.
from him. And just the history of the importance of the jewelry, where it's not, again, it's not just jewelry, but like the Tuareg, this particular cross of Agadez, where the history is that it's given to, the father gives it to the son,
mm-hmm.
and it is with the expression or the statement that, and I'm going to paraphrase it in a way that, this is given to the son as a rite of passage, and in reaching a certain age, and of the four points, it's not so much, it's not a Christian cross, but it represents the four corners of the globe, of the world, which is to say that none of us know where and when we're going to die.
Wow.
And, so it could be at any particular place and time. And not only that, each particular cross that's made, it represents an area of Niger, of Africa,
mm-hmm.
where that person's from. You know, whereas we have our towns, and I could say I'm from New York, I'm from the Lower East Side, or I'm from wherever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The concept is there in Africa. So it's like not having that, because they are originally a nomad tribe, but still these particular specific crosses represent where they were from, you know,
mm-hmm.
in that particular area. And it was just so fascinating, and it just resonated with me, you know, of, again, the importance of what we wear in terms of these misconception of just a regular piece of jewelry or adornment. It has so much more meaning, and it's also a bookmark in time for people.
Oh, wow,
you know,
okay.
That piece represents, a special moment in one's life. It could have been a gift. It could have been a memento, a souvenir of something significant. So
mm-hmm.
there's a lot that goes into as we just say, jewelry, you know.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I want to ask both of you something which is more fundamental, which is, where are you located? What building?
That's a good point.
I'm in building 101.
Okay.
The second floor. Yeah, I'm in Studio 2211. Yes.
Okay. Are you near Leslie up there?
Persian?
Leslie Prentice. Do you know who that
Prentice,
is?
Prentice, excuse me. Yes, she is down to the left of me. I'm right across from Derek Lynch. And
you're near
here.
Her. Okay,
yes,
what
exactly.
about... What about the gentleman?
Yes, I'm in building 101 as well on the first floor.
Okay.
And
all
my
right.
studio number is 1111. And
okay.
I'm right near the, I guess that would be the north side of the, where the parking lot is when you first come into that building on the north side, of the building.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, so I'm right down there.
So we're all in building 101.
Oh,
so
yes.
where are you, Mr. Tuggle? Where is your
studio? I'm like when you come in the front. If you come in the front of the building,
mm-hmm.
I'm right across from where where Estelle's studio is.
Yes.
Near the office.
Yeah.
Near the office.
I'm right across from her. Well, not directly across. Do either of you know David Anderson? He's been there a long time.
I don't think I do.
But no, I don't.
He does portraits, and now he's branching out into other things, but he's primarily known for that. He's right next door to me, and there's a woman who does who's directly across from me named Maeve Cockham. She does all these landscapes of mm-hmm. wine country, and she has a large space. My own space is small, but hers is huge. And
what's the number of your space?
1320.
Okay.
As soon as you come in the door, mm-hmm. and you turn, and you turn. If you come in the door, you turn right. And it's right there, and it's right next to we're all of us. There's a little group of us on the corner. One woman, she does sculptures. Her name is Marilyn Kuntz or something like that. And then there's David, and then there my little studio is there, and then. Estelle is right at the end of it, and she has all her students' work, and she's an art teacher. I think she teaches high school. It's a very, very diverse and interesting group of folks. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really wonderful that... go ahead.
Sorry, please.
Oh, I was just going to say it's really wonderful that... you know, that there is the 25th anniversary Spring Open Studios at the Shipyard, and it's going to really be wonderful. It's free, and it's May 3rd and 4th, and you'll be there from 11 to 6, and there
right.
are seven buildings. It's like, wow, so phenomenal.
Right.
And, yeah, and even the Elosis Creek Studios, I mean, there's like, Shipyard, and then there's like another collection of studios that are connected but not physically connected. So people
right.
can visit shipyardartist.com for the main open studios, and then they could visit thepointart.com/islaiscreek.html. for the other studios, so it's like you actually probably need to spend 2 days out there.
Well, I think you need to spend 2 days, and I think it's kind of 2 days that would be interesting, because right now they're going to have a jazz group out there. They're going to have all kind of activities for kids, for family.
Yes, they're Riveropolis.
And so, yeah, and so there's all kinds of things going on. So, yeah, easily a person can just, you know, like when my friends come out, they don't just come to see me. They could probably do that in 20 minutes, but, they get a chance to go all over and see all these different, you know, each studio you walk into is a different world, you know.
Yeah.
And so you get a chance to not only look at the work, but you get a chance to talk to the people who've done it. And you know, it's just very interesting, and I think I find it very, I've learned something, you know. I mean, just doing this talk, you know, I've learned something about the two people who I've not met, you know, so this has been an education for me, you know.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to visiting with you guys at some point.
Yeah.
I'm coming in extra early, and I will sneak out at one point. I've written down your studio number, so I will be coming by. And also, too, I like to pop out every now and then just to get to mingle a little bit, and like step out in the hallway or outside and see what's going on in terms of feeling the crowd of people. And And I'm really looking forward to really checking out the general events like the pop-up food market, and they've got a kids zone going on. And I understand there's also going to be a treasure hunt that's going to
take
kids
into
artist
videos.
That's right. Discover their secrets. You know, and I'm like, you know, I don't know what that's about, but I want to, like, kind of tap into that a bit. And also, like, you know, I hope people also remember, too, that this is all free. And so it's like a full family event, you know,
It's a healthy family event, too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and
it's,
you know, and so the 2 days actually is not enough to actually, you know, explore all the different things that go on there, you know, so.
Yeah, well, I forgot to mention the Hunters Point Shipyard is located at Innes Avenue and Donahue Street in San Francisco. The zip is 94124. And the other, Alasas Creek Studios, located at 1 Rankin Street in San Francisco, same zip code, so they must be close by.
Right.
And, and I want to mention again that Mr. Clarence Towers' studio is 111. And he's on the first floor. And
one more one.
Oh, 11-11, yes, exactly. And his website is towersphoto.com. And Ms. Naya Lark's studio is 2211, which I think means she's on the second floor. Is that what that means?
Okay.
All right. And her website is Naya Lark Jewelry Design.com. And then Mr. Charles Tuggle's studio, first floor, across from the, I think the office, which sounds like it should be pretty strategic to be at a
front. Yeah, it's not near the,
it's near
the office.
Yeah,
but it's,
near the office. Yeah, 1320 is the studio
exactly.
number. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so, if you have another minute or two, I wanted to maybe go do one more round with a question, sort of in closing. I wanted to ask you if you could speak to. The art making is and the aesthetic around sort of how human beings, you know, we make art intentionally, and the art that we make, it's a part of our making ourselves as human beings. Hopefully, you know, when we're born, we're human, but you know, it's a process that we have to keep on reinventing and reinforcing, because there's so many things that could take us out of our form, literally, in the world that can challenge us. And so, as artists, you know, you're sort of like right there in the mix, you know, remaking, stirring that brew of what makes us human. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of, you know, the aesthetic, and also being a person of African descent, which adds another layer to that, because there's so many things that can take us out of our form as African people in the diaspora. You know, there's not a lot of reinforcement going on, positive reinforcements a lot of times in being a black person, particularly if you look black. Sometimes you can pass, but other times you can't get away from it. So there's a kind of a you know, there's a tension there, and I just wonder if you could talk about sort of your aesthetic and how it informs your humanity.
Hmm.
No, if you ponder on that, I'll let you two think about it. Well, I'll go ahead and I'll kick it off. I would say that. I think the word that I immediately focus on when you say is process. And creation is a process, whether it be in an art form or if it's related to who we are as human beings. And if we're fortunate, we hopefully are not in any place in time where that process or that level of development as humans is stifled, which I think historically, as black people, there have been many, many, many times historically that our development has been stifled, our attempts have been made. I would say in speaking to my actual art form and doing metalsmithing, it's a lot of it isn't just taking raw material and tools and an idea. It's you have to bring yourself into the process. As I instruct, and again, I let students know that you are always critiquing and examining and seeing where you are in each step of the way, because it's all making that one design is a process. You cannot skip over. You cannot shortchange. If you do, the end result is you're not going to be happy with it. It's like you're cheating yourself in a way. And I liken a lot of what the process of metalsmithing, I liken it to life in general. You find out about yourself in this particular process of metalsmithing, just like I think that we find out about ourselves if we really explore and delve into our medium as artists in general. And it's always been about growth for me. And it's wonderful when you have like, and I perhaps, you know, two of you can also attest to this, is that when you have people, like I've had come in and say, oh, I've been with you, I've been watching your work, you know, over the years, I've been collecting, and I love the direction you're headed in. And some have said, I've seen how you've grown. And you know, and that's a wonderful thing, you know, and because it's not just the work itself, but it's also your identity, and it's who you are that grows in the process. I would like to see, I think, and to speak more of a people standpoint, I would like to bring more of an education to the Black community. Again, it's about opportunities, what's out there. It's without the awareness, then, you know, the Black community is, you know, they don't know what's there. It's like the shipyard being right there at Hunter's Point, you know, the country's largest artist colony. You know, there's so many resources there, occasional opportunities there for the community, and but yet so many don't know that we're there. You know, that can be advantageous to some degree, but for the most part, as far as awareness, it isn't, and I would like to see more promotion in that regard.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, I you know, as far as how I got involved with my medium, which is really basically the exploration of light, I really looked at it just as an opportunity to explore as a creative outlet. And of course, everyone enjoys photography. It's very accessible now. But as time had passed and I'd done all the practical applications, some of which I'm still involved with, such as commercial photography and more fundamental efforts to help clients and colleagues in their various pursuits, I've enjoyed the opportunity to be able to tell a story, which is how I was attracted to the Western Imager Cowboy Project. And I learned so much from that, and I was always delighted when I tell people that I'm working on something like that their eyebrows go up. I guess because not many people are doing something like that in one respect, but in the other, it's a subject that has not been widely explored, at least not that I've seen thus far. And so it was, as a former journalist and filmmaker and working in television, I found that to be a nice and interesting opportunity and learning opportunity for me as well to share those images from the places that I've traveled and from the families that I've met and the athletes that I've seen getting involved with rodeo and horsemanship and all these other exploits that are associated with Western life. And so for me, it's been just a great learning opportunity and opportunity to share in that experience with colleagues as well as the public. And hopefully I can continue for some time to come in doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess it's my turn, huh? in terms of the actual work, you were saying you were interested in exploration of light. I was always interested in exploration of color and the psychology of color and how color affects people. When I was in art school, I studied, you know, the drawing and painting and all these things. And it was all Eurocentric aesthetics. This is what, you know, this is what color should do. This is what art is. And then when I studied art history, it was primarily, it was European art history, Pre-Raphaelite movement, the Renaissance, and all those things. And one of the reasons that I came to San Francisco, to California for graduate school is because the school that I came for to get an MA in art history, they had said, well, you can explore what you wanted to explore. And so I started writing on art history of Latin America, Africa, doing comparative studies in Asia, only to find out that the supervisors really wasn't that comfortable with that. You know, they weren't like, "What? Wait a minute!" You know, they were. You know, I mean, it was a subtle thing. They were very approving. And, you know, I was getting, you know, I was doing well, but it was a subtle thing. And then right in the middle of the art history, when I, you know, I switched to New York Abstract Expressionism, people were very happy with that, you know, and I was able to finish the MA thesis with that because it was something they could relate to. And so I could see right away that our own history as minority people have been sort of sidestepped unless, and also in the universities, you study these things, but they're special sort of niche studies. They're not like prominent. And so I wanted to do that, and later in terms of the MA stuff in printmaking, I wanted to use my my school knowledge and processes of printmaking and painting all this to help educate or to bring a focus onto Black history, to art history. As I studied and knew people who were involved in music or art, I wanted to make that in some way accessible to Black kids and to Black people generally, that to sort of ignite their interest in these things, to have them to ask questions. So I don't know if that answers anything, but that.
Yeah, it did. You know, there was no answer that I was anticipating, so, you know, it's all good, so to speak. Wow, it's been, gosh, so lovely speaking to all of you, Ms. Lark, Mr. Tuggle, and Mr. Towers, about your work, and looking forward to meeting you probably Saturday, maybe Saturday and Sunday at the 25th Anniversary Shipyard Artist Spring Open Studios, May 3rd and 4th. 11 until 6, I believe. Yeah, 11 to 6 at the Hunters Point Shipyard. And the, how do you pronounce that? I'm not sure if I'm killing the name of the creek or not. How do you say that?
Hunters Point Shipyard?
No.
Isthmus Creek.
Isthmus, thank you. Yeah, Isthmus Creek Studios. So the Naval Shipyard is at Ennis and Donahue Street. There's 7 buildings, you can't miss it. And Isthmus Creek Studios is at 1 Rankin Street. And I'm not certain how close they are, but they have the same zip code. So, Yeah, so you should definitely, folks should definitely try to get on down there. It should be really awesome. And again, thank you so much for the conversation. Hopefully we will be speaking again, at some point about your work, which continues, and I'm looking forward to seeing if I can afford to collect any of your work.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was great. Thank you so much for this opportunity, and I will be looking for you, and I will definitely be seeing the view as well at studios. Remember, early on Saturday or Sunday, I'll be popping in and introducing myself, but I'll be there.
All right. Cool.
Okay.
Well, you all have a great day.
Thank you
very
much.
Thank you so much.
This has been very stimulating, and I appreciate it. So, thanks.
Yeah. Looking forward to further conversations. Good. Take care.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. I want to mention this. I wanted to mention, since I brought up Jack London's African-American foster mother, and I didn't remember her name, but her name is Virginia Prentice, and she's the topic of a really wonderful book written by Mary Rudge, For the Love of Jack London. And that's available. So I think we will close out with Gina Breedlove. We started with her piece, The Sea, because we were talking about water earlier on in the show, and sort of water, water security for not just California, but other places in the world that do not have clean drinking water. And we were talking with a representative from let me see, what organization is that? I am drawing a blank. Let's see. Oh, here are my notes. we were talking with Marie-Laura Recambre, the Program Director for Water for Life and Peace, and the organization is Green Cross. And so we are going to close with Breathe. I guess we're not going to, because we're having difficulty. So I guess we will play that another time. So thanks so much for joining us, and we'll close out now. And join us again at 8 o'clock on Friday for another edition of Wanda's Picks. Peace and blessings.